and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, March 10th, 2023. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, national politics reporter Stephen Wenzel is joined by Dr. Martha Painter. Painter last joined Rabble Radio in June of 2022 to talk about the misconceptions people have about access to abortion in Canada and the other threats facing reproductive justice in this country. Dr. Martha Painter is an assistant professor at the Faculty of Nursing at the University of New Brunswick, where her clinical teaching and research focus on the intersection of reproductive health and the criminal justice system. She is the affiliate scientist for the Nova Scotia Women's Choice Clinic and the founder and past chair of Wellness Within, an organization for health and justice, the only organization in Canada dedicated to advancing reproductive justice for people experiencing criminalization. She is also the author of Abortion to Abolition, Reproductive Health and Justice in Canada. Today, Wenzel and Painter discuss a new guidebook for providing abortion care in prison, a new jail facility being built in New Brunswick, and the need for universal contraception coverage in Nova Scotia. Here are Wenzel and Painter in conversation. Take a listen.
All right, Martha, it's so great to be chatting with you again. The last time we spoke, you had just released your book, Abortion to Abolition. And I'm wondering, what have you been up to since?
Well, Stephen, I moved to Fredericton, New Brunswick, which is actually my hometown, to take a job at University of New Brunswick, their campus there in the Faculty of Nursing. So I did that. And I've really spent a lot of the past 6 months kind of adjusting to new position, new place. I mean, it is my hometown, but new life, as it were. So that's sort of dominated. And then really one of the big things that we've been working on, in particular since we had our first Atlantic Abortion Summit in November for all the Atlantic region, we held that at the Health Law Institute at Dalhousie University. Stemming from that, we developed a New Brunswick Abortion Care Network, an independent platform for abortion care professionals across the province to work together to advance public understanding of access to care and to work towards centralizing and developing efficiencies for self-referral processes to both medication and procedural abortion providers across the province. So those have kind of dominated my past 6 months.
And so Wellness Within, they have this new guidebook for abortion care for people in prison. Can you tell me how that came together and what kind of objectives it has?
So, you know, although we've had tremendous gains in terms of abortion access across Canada, and in particular since 2015, one population that, of course, Wellness Within is focused on and engaged with all the time that have been left out of a lot of the progress in terms of abortion access is the incarcerated population. And we're doing a broad study with a bunch of different parts. We looked at internationally all of the research that had ever been conducted about abortion access for people in prison and have a scoping review coming out momentarily, open access, about those findings. And then the next piece of our project was to work with a geospatial specialist and analyze the distance to procedural care from every one of the prisons designated for women and girls across the country. This is sort of a sister or sibling project to something we did several years ago where we identified all of the prisons for women and girls because it's across multiple systems and there is no one list of all of these facilities. So we had to create one. And then once we did that, we then measured distance to maternity care, which, of course, is in line with our flagship program to offer voluntary doula service to incarcerated people. So this measuring procedural abortion availability was a sensible next step. The reason we focused on procedural abortion, even though there is all of these potential gains to be made with medication abortion, is twofold. One is medication abortion is available through primary care. Any family doctor or nurse practitioner could prescribe it. And it would be, frankly, impossible to measure the distance to every single family doctor or nurse practitioner across the country relative to all of these facilities. So it's just a nonsensical project. But the other and more interesting reason that it's problematic is because medication abortion is not compatible with the prison environment. So in theory, medication abortion is this fantastic advance because you can have your abortion on your own terms, by your own hand, in your own home. But in a prison, of course, it's not your home and you don't have control over your environment. You don't have access to a shower. You don't have access to Advil. You don't have access to menstrual supplies for the pretty intense bleeding that you are going to experience. You don't have any support. And most dangerously, prisons are only staffed till about 11 p.m. with actual healthcare professionals. So, you know, if you're having a medication abortion at your house and you're one of the very few, but it does happen, people who hemorrhages, you can call an ambulance and get yourself to a hospital. You cannot do that if you do not have a phone because you are in a jail cell. So the vulnerability is really very concerning. And I think a healthcare professional would be hard pressed to prescribe medication abortion, knowing there were such significant limitations on access to emergency care. So given all that, we said, you know what, we're not going to try to measure distance to medication abortion prescribers. We'll focus on procedural. And that's what we've done with this guide. Obviously, any procedural abortion provider would also be able to prescribe the medication pill. But what we found in doing this analysis is that you have everything from literally meters, just 10 or so meters down the street, you can access procedural abortion from some centers, all the way up to more than 700 kilometers of travel being required. So what that demonstrates is that there's incredible inequity between people in prison, depending on where geographically they have been sent. And we know that in particular, and most obviously within the federal system, where you can end up anywhere, right? You can be from Nova Scotia and end up at the Edmonton Institution for Women. It's a federal system, and where you're from is irrelevant to where you end up. So what we're able to demonstrate with this project is that this is an inequity that when you think about obligation under the Corrections and Conditional Release Act or under international law, under provincial legislation, that obligation for the state to be responsible for all healthcare and that healthcare be equal to what is available in the community, you see there's this systemic and inherent problem in the way things are set up. So that's what we're able to speak to. We're also able to just say, listen, if you didn't know, this is where the closest facility is. And it's helpful reciprocally for the abortion care providers to realize, oh, you know, there's a jail 100 meters down the road or 76 kilometers down the road. And for healthcare staff or also correctional staff within prisons to recognize, okay, so if and when this becomes a need for someone at this prison, we will know who to call, where to go.
All right. When I was reading the press release for this guidebook, Martha, I noticed that it mentioned that this guidebook is a part of a larger project with Wellness Within. I think you might have alluded to that a little bit, but what is this overarching project and its goal?
So the overarching project is looking at, in every way we can try to, look at abortion access for people in prisons. When we did our international synthesis of what research has been conducted around the globe, there's very, very little content from Canada, well, almost nothing. And so we wanted to begin to fill that gap. And we've done this geospatial analysis, we've done the knowledge synthesis internationally. A piece that we're working on right now is through access to information requests, freedom of information requests, we've pulled together the policies in each of the prisons or correctional systems, each provincial and territorial correctional system, as well as the feds, to be able to look at, all right, what language, if any, do they have that governs the prevention of pregnancy and the termination of pregnancy? And unsurprisingly, there's very little language at all. The only time that pregnancy, birth, etc. is mentioned in the Commissioner's Directive 800, which is the health regulations internal to the federal prison system. The only time it's mentioned is point 20, which is if you are going to have a kid, you're going to give birth, you should give birth in a hospital. That's it. Nothing about pregnancy prevention, nothing about pregnancy termination, nothing about perinatal care, really, and certainly nothing that acknowledges actually we have different places to give birth. So the absence of a policy can problematically make people think that the policy is negative, or because there's no policy saying that you can have something, then you therefore can't. So then the next stage of this project will be to interview people who have experienced incarceration, as well as prison staff, to understand, okay, what is your process when someone wants to terminate a pregnancy? What do you do? Who do you call? Who has to reveal information to whom? Where's the confidentiality? Where's the privacy? What's the pathway? How long does it take, et cetera, et cetera. So that's going to be the next stage that I don't anticipate will start until next year, but really an important part to understand the context. And from there, you know, our hope is to be able to comment on and make recommendations about the abortion care for people experiencing incarceration.
It's interesting that you mentioned you've recently moved to Fredericton, because, you know, while Wellness Within has called for a moratorium on building new detention facilities in Nova Scotia, we're actually seeing a development of a new jail facility in Fredericton moving forward. And so basically kind of what we saw in November, Fredericton City Council voted to sell land to the province for just over $1 million. But in order for that land to be able to be accessed as a jail facility, it needed to be rezoned. And so the Planning Advisory Committee actually came back and said, no, we don't think that this is worthy of you know, changing the zoning requirements. And council came back and said, we're going to do it anyway. And so I'm wondering, what are your thoughts about this proposed facility in the Fredericton area, and what are some of the common concerns that that you've been hearing about?
Well, I think we can back it up, Stephen, and start with why are we even doing this in the first place? So the argument that there's overburdened prison facilities across the province, that they're double bunking, they're beyond capacity, and we know when facilities are beyond capacity, there are escalations in violence that are very serious with lots of other repercussions. So once you've escalated violence, then you're going to escalate punitive responses. More people are in seg, more people are isolated, they're angry, then the violence starts again. So we know that it's a very dangerous cocktail to have prisons too full. But why are they too full? Why are we criminalizing things that should not be criminalized? And the big ticket in New Brunswick is really a very intolerant approach to substance use and, frankly, to poverty. And so we're seeing these jails fill up because we're not able to come up with more creative solutions, more humane and compassionate responses to substance use and poverty. So, I mean, that's the problem. And this idea that the conservative government has to respond to a manufactured problem, crime has not really increased by any means. It's just the punitiveness of the response to criminalized drug use that has increased. Anyway, there isn't a ton of public support for this, really. And the Higgs government has been unable to demonstrate that this is an evidence-based proposal. But Fredericton City Council has basically said, well, they're going to do it. So if they do it here, or they do it there, whatever, they're going to do it. So we're going to let them do it. I mean, that's basically the vibe coming out of Fredericton City Council, which is unfortunate because, you know, City Council is saying, well, this is the only mechanism that we have, whether or not to let them rezone it. And, you know, we can't really say no. But of course you can say no. Of course you can, right? And so they've really, very unfortunate the way they cowardly caved to what could have been. It could have been a lever, that, and we don't have a lot of them, right? If this jail does get built, the concern that's top of mind for me is how prisons in general decrease the health status of the community in which they're located. So you have increases in infectious disease, which are the most obvious, but you also have an escalation in mental health concerns, suicidality, self-harm behaviors, sexual assault. You know, just was it yesterday that yet another guard, I think it was in Edmonton, was charged with sexually assaulting a prisoner? You know, these are locations that are sites of injury, violence, sickness, rape. And it's not healthy to have them in our communities. And Fredericktonians know that, and they really don't want this thing to be built. There was a lot of opposition from the neighborhood recognizing, well, I'll be honest with you, there was a lot of emphasis on the impact it would have on property values. But I think there's an understanding that this is simply not good for the health of a community. So it's to be seen how this will play out. Is it going to be one of these scenarios we see so often where if you build it, they will fill it and we'll have yet more people in prison? Because that's what we've seen time and time again. You argue that you need more space because you're filling the prisons up, and then you fill up yet another one. And this is at a time when actually crime is going down constantly. So hopefully we'll be able to pay close attention and, well, frankly, hopefully we can interfere with this or delay this enough that it doesn't happen. That's really my greatest hope.
Yeah, I mean, the petition opposing the facility got more than 800 signatures just from people in the community. But one question that I have is, if the government is pushing this, the need for this facility because of an increase in drug crimes, that's not really going to do anything to help the overpopulation of other jails in the province, because, you know, trafficking sentences are served in the federal system. So the people who are committing these crimes are going to be sent to federal facilities. What's your kind of take on that?
Well, eventually, if convicted, but keep in mind that most people who are incarcerated in this country are actually on remand, and most provincial prisoners are actually remanded. So the bulk of the people that are occupying these spaces haven't been tried, haven't been convicted, haven't been sentenced. The idea that this will somehow decrease drug crime, but actually we see that the trauma of incarceration, the abusive context that people are exposed to, are what drive more mental illness, more trauma, and more need for substance use. We also see that prisons are sites of trafficking, and it's not prisoners generally who are bringing the stuff in, right? So I'm pretty pessimistic that this can have anything but quite a serious negative impact on the community.
Okay. And just to bring this all back full circle, and talking about healthcare and trying to find solutions for abortion and access to abortion, Wellness Within has been advocating for universal contraception coverage in Nova Scotia. That's something that the British Columbia government put forward in their budget for 2023. I'm wondering, how would that help make access to abortion more equitable?
Well, we're in a situation right now where abortion is publicly funded. Medication abortion is publicly funded. A hospital-based abortion is $2,000, easy, of taxpayer money. That's publicly funded. And yet, any type of contraception, of prescription contraception, from a $30 monthly pack of birth control pills to a $400 IUD intrauterine device, none of that is publicly funded. And the consequence of that is that some people are unable to afford contraception and are dependent on abortion as a way to manage their fertility. And while, of course, as abortion care professionals, we are there for every patient who needs us, welcome them, care for them, treat them with love, we do not want our patients to have to rely on our services, which are harder on their bodies, when they could have universally covered, publicly funded contraception. It's simply not fair that the people with a uterus who have well-paying jobs with solid benefit packages, that they have the private insurance that allows them to control their fertility and people living in poverty, people in precarious employment do not have that right. That is simply unfair. And it's truly a very clear gender equity issue. It's only people with a uterus who have to experience the consequences of failed or absent contraception and unintended pregnancy. And the cost, the pure direct financial cost of preventing this burden on your body then gets downloaded onto people with a uterus, again, exclusively. And it's just not fair.
All right. I think that's a great place to leave it. Martha, I always learn so much from speaking with you. It's such a pleasure to chat. And thank you for the work that you do and the respect and dignity that you give your clients every day.
Thanks so much, Stephen. Great to talk with you.
That was Rabble's national politics reporter, Stephen Wenzel, and Dr. Martha Painter in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Martha and Stephen. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, we'll hand it over to Nick Seabrook. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week, national politics reporter Stephen Wenzel explained how recent layoffs at Global News and its parent company, Corus Entertainment, not only put journalists at risk, but democracy as well. Rachel Gilmore announced on social media that she was one of the journalists that Global had chosen to lay off. Just weeks before, Gilmore had been one of three reporters to receive the prestigious Tara Singh Hare Memorial Award. Gilmore had pioneered Global's reporting on the popular social media platform TikTok and had broken key stories about the 2022 trucker convoy that occupied the nation's capital. Gilmore had been the target of harassment for her work at Global, including threats of assault and rape. But despite the danger her award-winning work on behalf of Global had placed her in, the company was still comfortable with releasing her. The union Unifor represents more than 800 employees at Corus Entertainment. Unifor President Lana Payne condemned the layoffs and stated that those workers are the backbone of our democracy. Also in national politics, calls are growing for Canada to stop criminalizing those living with HIV. Experts across Canada are calling on Parliament to amend the criminal code to reform the criminalization of HIV non-disclosure. A February panel hosted by the Dalhousie Criminal Law Students Association in Halifax, Nova Scotia, explored the ways the vague and broad interpretation and application of the law has failed those living with HIV. Those who do not disclose their status are charged with aggravated sexual assault, but the law is too broad and has dire consequences for those living with the disease. One individual is on the sex offender registry because she gave her partner a condom that they did not use. Two others were sexually assaulted by their partners, but because they did not disclose their status, they were the ones who were convicted with aggravated sexual assault. Richard Elliott, former executive director of the HIV Legal Network, said for true justice to be achieved, the underlying law must be changed. In labor news this week, and in recognition of International Women's Day, labor reporter Gabriela Kaluga-Kasuga highlights five incredible women in the labor movement and the important work that they do. Recent years have seen massive gains up for diversity and equity in labor leadership in Canada. In 2021, Yolanda McLean became the first Black woman to be elected Secretary-Treasurer of the Canadian Union of Public Employees, Ontario. Last year, Lana Payne became the first woman elected national president for Unifor. J.P. Hornick, a longtime leader in her union and an avid women's rights, equity, LGBTQ+, and HIV/AIDS activist, became the first openly queer person to be president of the Ontario Public Service Employees Union, OPSU. While these high-profile and historic milestones are important to know, there are other passionate women in the labor movement who may have slipped under your radar. Kaluga-Kasuga writes, learn more about these incredible women in her story on Rabble.ca this week. On Parliament Hill, debate continues on how to address alleged interference by China in the last federal election. Rabble parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg reports that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau avoided calls for an inquiry for the time being by promising to appoint a special rapporteur to investigate the allegations. For Pierre Poilievre's Conservatives, however, this does not go far enough, and they have leveled accusations against Trudeau being afraid of a public inquiry. Nirenberg points out, however, that Polyev himself tried to make it more difficult for the Commissioner of Elections to investigate electoral irregularities with his Fair Elections Act that he tabled when he was a minister in the Stephen Harper government. Notably, there have been few calls to investigate foreign electoral interference made by foreign-owned companies and lobbyist groups. Join Rabble for a very special book launch webinar on Thursday, March 30th, 2023, at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Through the experiences of the contributing authors, Advocating for Palestine in Canada offers an indispensable and first-hand view into the complex social and historical forces at work in one of the world's most urgent issues, and one which also has a huge implication for freedoms enjoyed by Canadians. This webinar will feature contributing authors from the book to share their unique views and wide experiences on advocating for Palestine in Canada, revealing a solid civil society movement in the face of strong institutional opposition. Our panelists share how they came to Palestine activism, why they continue, and where they see the movement going. This event is sponsored by Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, CJPME, Fernwood Publishing, Another Story Bookshop, Independent Jewish Voices Canada, with partners Zatoon, and of course, Rabble.ca. Save your spot for this free online event with the link in our show notes, or for all of you listening on radio, find the link to this event on Rabble.ca. Finally, join Off the Hill this month as we discuss the 2023 federal budget. The federal budget for 2023 is soon to be announced. Who decides the budget? Who influences it? And where does all that money go? Last year's budget was aimed at growing the economy in Canada and making life more affordable and equitable. But did it? Our guests will dissect these questions and more in our Off the Hill panel this month. Guests include MP Leah Gazan, Rabble columnist and policy researcher Chuka Ejekam, economist David MacDonald, and Rabble parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg, hosted by Robin Brown and Libby Davies. Save your spot for this free event today. Join us this March 23rd, 2023, 7:30 p.m. Eastern, 4:30 p.m. Pacific. As always, you can find the full version of these stories and much, much more on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.